Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Today we'll be reading chapter 11. This is a chapter in which Krishna leaves Vrindavan. So we're now about one third of the way through the 10th canto. And we will wrap up Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes with this chapter. Mostly. But the sections on Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes are said to be most perfect. Pastimes in Dwarka are perfect, Mathura are more perfect, and Vrindavan most perfect. But the later chapters are also very instructive and sweet. So these are beginning with Akrura's departure, or taking Krishna from Vrindavan. However, before we get to that, just a bit about yesterday's discussion. You remember this section at the end of their, or just before the Rasa dance, after Krishna returned, when the gopis ask him in a very kind of halting way about how is it that some people don't seem to show love even when they are loved. And they're asking him in a very indirect way, what are you doing? What were you doing leaving us? They're very shy about it, very oblique. So Krishna answers in such a nice way. We didn't get a chance to discuss, but I just want to mention it. Anyone remember he says there are three kinds of people who cannot reciprocate or who do not reciprocate love? Those who are business-minded, they give love only when someone else is giving them love or something else. Right? And? Yes, those people causelessly give love. Yeah, it's not that they can't. They give love without thought of reciprocation. And he mentions parents as well as saints. And Prabhupada said that the love of a mother for her child is the closest thing to pure love of God that exists in this world. Selfless, completely selfless love, as close as can be. And finally, he says there are those who just can't reciprocate or don't reciprocate love. They're just so self-centered or incapacitated that even if somebody loves them, they cannot give love back. So after explaining these different dynamics, then he says, as far as our relationship is concerned, your love for me is so perfect that I cannot possibly reciprocate it. You gave up everything for me, and there's just no way I can give back the love that you have given me. So he says, your own love and devotion will have to be its own reward. No, I misspoke. There's three types of people, three ways of reciprocating love. Those who do it only as a business, those who do it totally selflessly, without thought of return, and those who are just too self-centered to give love at all. Okay? So, these three different ways, Derek, not three people who can't, three different ways people respond. If somebody loves someone, then there's three different types of responses. One is, I'll give you love if you give me love. Another is, I'll give you love regardless of whether or not you give me love. And the third is, I can't love you back even if you love me, baby. Okay? No. He's just answering their question philosophically. Okay? But then he goes on to say that the love that you have for me is unparalleled by anyone. And so there's no way I could reciprocate your love. You understand? Okay. So it's a very nice discussion there on this subject. So once again, it sets us apart Krishna's relationship with the gopis from ordinary ordinary, right, loving, so-called loving affairs, which are generally in the first category. You love me and I'll love you. Otherwise, forget it. You know, business-like. Okay? Except Prabhupada says for the, or Krishna says rather for the saints or for the parents. They can give love without concern of reciprocation. Okay, chapter 11. Akrura, Arishta. As Krishna was preparing for a rasa dance at dusk, a demon named Arishta, who was fearsome, cruel, and brusque, descended on Vrindavan as a bull of massive size. His hooves tore ruts in Mother Earth and left her terrorized. With glaring eyes, his tail erect, Arishta roared and fussed. His sharpened, wildly swinging horns turned levees into dust. Clouds gathered round his back hump. They mistook it for a peak. And as he thundered here and there, his stool and urine leaked. Arista's awful bellowing caused people's hearts to pound. The pregnant cows and women all miscarried at the sound. Domesticated animals fled quickly through the fields, and everyone cried Krishna with their terror unconcealed. On seeing the community distraught and taking flight, Lord Krishna called, "Don't be afraid," and dared the bull to fight. "You fool, you wicked rascal, what do you intend to do when I am here to take the lives of miscreants like you?" To further agitate the demon, Krishna slapped his arms and leaned upon a friend and faced the bull without alarm. Arishta pawed the ground, enraged, and raised his tail so high it passed his hump, attracting all the floating clouds nearby. His head held low, his horns straight out, his rage intensified. Arishta glared at Krishna from the rims of bloodshot eyes. Stampeding straight at Krishna to destroy him then and there, the bull shot like the thunderbolt of Indra through the air. The deadly bull closed in on him, but Krishna didn't mind. He seized Arista's horns and threw him 18 steps behind. He looked to be an elephant who tosses on his back a smaller rival elephant who foolishly attacks. Repulsed in such degrading terms, Arishta, with a snort, stood up and shook his head and charged again in fierce retort. Sweat pouring from his body, running fast and breathing hard, Arishta pounced on Krishna with a reckless disregard. Again Lord Krishna seized his horns and tossed the bull aside. He thrashed Arishta like a rag and kicked his scruffy hide. At last the Lord yanked out Arishta's horn up to the root and beat him with it forcefully until he stilled the brute. Arishta rolled his eyes, retched blood, and felt his frame implode. While passing stool and urine, he was dragged to death's abode. The gods above, rejoicing with a loud triumphant sound, showed honor to Lord Krishna, tossing flowers to the ground. The Lord, who is a festival within the gopis' eyes, went home with Ram to celebrate the demon bull's demise. Lord Krishna is so versatile, as every bhakta knows. He's harder than a thunderbolt and softer than a rose. Kamsa's scheme. In Mathura, soon afterwards, Sri Narada, the sage, perceiving that Lord Krishna's life had entered a new stage, decided to see Kamsa, who was evil and misled. To expedite Lord Krishna's plans, the saintly caller said, "You've lost so many demons in Vrindavan recently. Are you aware that Krishna is the son of Devaki?" "Yes, Vasudeva exchanged his son for Nanda's baby girl, deceiving you, her parents, and the balance of the world. A prophecy has stated that your death will come about from Devaki's eighth son. That son is Krishna. Have no doubt. His older brother Ram is also Vasudeva's son. These nephews of King Nanda killed your demons one by one." On hearing this, King Kamsa's fury surged within his brain. He snatched his sword and shouted, "Vasudeva shall be slain!" But Narada reminded him, "Think well before you act. If you kill him, his sons will flee, but later they'll attack." So Kamsa sent his soldiers to imprison Devaki along with Vasudeva under tight security. He thought, I'll dispatch Keshi to make Krishna disappear. But if he fails, those foolish boys will seek their parents here. King Kamsa next assembled all his ministers and said, Dear Chanura and Mushtika, this Krishna wants me dead. You both are very famous for your wrestling skill and might. If Krishna reaches Mathura, you challenge him to fight. Erect a great arena. Let the people come and cheer. Invite the foremost wrestlers. Make a festive atmosphere. When Krishna and his brother are attracted to compete, my elephant will trample them beneath his massive feet. Chaturdasi is coming soon. Assemble beasts and ghee and hold a Vedic sacrifice so Shiva will be pleased. Completing his instructions, wicked Kamsa then decreed, Now bring Akrura, foremost of our dynasty, to me. Akrura, highly learned and respected through the land, appeared the perfect pawn for Kamsa's latest wicked plan. Akrura, he said gushingly, you generous, brilliant man, do me a little favor. Kamsa smiled and held his hand. As Indra turns to Vishnu for the most important tasks, I need a man like you who can accomplish what I ask. Proceed now to Vrindavan and return with Nanda's sons. Here, take our finest chariot, the new and shiny one. The gods, with help from Vishnu, sent these boys to murder me. Bring them to visit Mathura, where, confidentially, my elephant will trample them. And if they should survive, my wrestlers will confront them in the ring and take their lives. When they are dead, their father, Vasudeva, shall be next, and then I'll kill their relatives on this or that pretext. And when I kill my father, Ugrasena, who shall mourn? The earth, my friend, shall then be mine, devoid of any thorns. My friends in arms, Jarasandha, Dvidvida, and the rest, will help me kill remaining kings who fail to acquiesce. And that's my plan. Now bring those boys to savor their surprise. Our city and a wrestling match await their childish eyes. As Kamsa chuckled wickedly, the grave Akrura said, You've planned things quite precisely so that you'll come out ahead. And yet, one must be steady throughout failure or success. Despite our planning, fate alone determines what comes next. As an ordinary person plans and struggles and aspires, despite the fact that fate intrudes and stifles his desires, he gains, but then he loses, and he suffers. Nonetheless, I am your subject, duty-bound to honor your request. The foolish Kamsa listened, but he could not understand Akrura had discreetly laid a curse upon his plans. King Kamsa laughed, dismissed his staff, and strolled off on his own. Akrura, thinking deeply, left the palace and went home. Keshi. When Keshi arrived in a huge horse's form, he ravaged through Braj like a thunderous storm. His snort scared the people. The hairs on his mane split clouds and shook gods from their heavenly plains. When Krishna saw everyone running in fright, he challenged the demon to face him and fight. Although the beast happily met his request, his lion-like roar left the Lord unimpressed. Enraged, the beast charged with his mouth open wide, apparently trying to swallow the sky. The Lord seized his legs with a marvelous knack and spun him and threw him 100 yards back. The rogue lay unconscious and injured, but then he angrily stood and charged Krishna again. Lord Krishna so gracefully parried and faked, he looked like Garuda tormenting a snake. When Keshi reached Krishna, his mouth open wide, Lord Krishna propelled his left fist deep inside. It looked like a snake who, on hearing a sound, goes slithering into a hole in the ground. The fist of Lord Krishna took out Keshi's teeth and made a sensation of terrible heat. His arm then expanded beyond normal size, quite like a bare belly that swells when one dies. As Krishna's left fist enlarged deep in his throat, the demon's breath stopped, and he started to choke. With sweat and with kicks rolling eyes in his head, the demon passed stool, crumpled up, and fell dead. As Krishna withdrew his all-powerful arm, the beast lay where he could no longer cause harm. Without the least pride in his effortless coup, Lord Krishna sniffed flowers the demigods threw. Narada meets Krishna. My dear King Vishnurata, after Keshi was erased, sage Narada found Krishna in a solitary place. The sage saw Krishna's pastimes in Gokul were almost through, and eagerly he praised the Lord and forecast what he'd do. Immeasurable Krishna, perfect mystic, Lord Supreme, residing in the cave of every heart and yet unseen as if you were the fire buried deep within all wood. For you all things are organized and fully understood. You build, maintain, and break apart the planets and the stars. Your wishes come about at once, no matter what they are. And yet you've come in person to protect the godly souls and sport by killing demons, such as this gigantic foal. I see that, in a day or two, you'll kill Mathura's king, his elephant, and ministers and wrestlers in the ring. And then, I see, you'll marry many worthy, loyal wives while tracking down more demons and demolishing their lives. I see you driving Arjuna in some colossal war, destroying massive armies so they burden earth no more. I thank you, Krishna, perfect, pure, and undiluted Lord, for pastimes such as this that ease humanity's discord. Completing his predictions in a reverential voice, the foremost of the sages bowed to Krishna and rejoiced. As Narada departed, Krishna turned again to tend his father's many cows with the assistance of his friends. Vyomasura. The cows were grazing happily one day, as all the boys were busy playing games like those that every child enjoys. Some boys were thieves, some sheep, and others shepherds in their play. The thieves would steal the sheep when their protectors looked away. Observing this, Vyomasura, a demon, hatched a ploy and changed himself to look just like another cowherd boy. By acting as a sheep thief in the context of their play, he snatched those boys dressed up as sheep and carried them away. Then Vyoma hid his prisoners within a cave nearby and sealed it with a boulder, cackling out aloud, "Goodbye!" When Vyoma next returned to take still other boys away, he found himself arrested as if he were lion's prey. This Vyoma's so-called cowherd play was just about to end, for Krishna had been watching, and he seized the bogus friend. Resuming his gigantic form, the demon rose to fight, but could not shake off Krishna, whose embrace was much too tight. The gods above intently watched Lord Krishna's swift attack, as instantly the flawless Lord threw Vyoma on his back. As Vyoma wriggled, struggled, pushed, and strained to be released, Lord Krishna choked his life out like a sacrificial beast. Proceeding to the cave where many boys had been entrapped, Lord Krishna set them free as all the gods in heaven clapped. The boys and gods commended Krishna, singing out his praise, as Krishna ambled home in the most nonchalant of ways. Akrura's Prayers. While Narada praised Krishna and Vyoma had been killed, Akrura drove a chariot to Vraj as Kamsa willed. While thinking about Krishna in an endless mood of bliss, Akrura sped along the road while pondering like this. What pious work have I completed? What austerity! I can't recall what rituals or gifts of charity are coming back to me today as this outstanding chance to see Lord Krishna's lotus feet and gain his soothing glance. Since I am a materialist, completely self-absorbed, I think it is as difficult for me to see the Lord as it would be for Shudras, who are plain and lowly born, to chant the Vedic mantras in the proper style and form. But why should I berate myself? Yes, even hearts like mine, adrift upon the brutal flood of unrelenting time, can climb out of the torrent to the safety of the shore by making some arrangements to behold the faultless Lord. Today my sins have been erased. My life will be complete when I behold the cherished sight of Krishna's lotus feet. Indeed, King Kamsa favored me, dispatching me this way, for seeing Krishna's toenails gleam shall make me unafraid. Lord Krishna's soft feet and Lord Krishna himself are worshipped by gods and the goddess of wealth. adorned by the gopis with red kumkum dust. Those feet carry Krishna from morning till dusk. The deer on my right are an omen of grace, that soon I'll behold Krishna's beautiful face. His soft curly hair frames his cheeks and his nose. His smile sets his lotus-like dark eyes aglow. Lord Krishna has come to deliver the earth. My eyes will embrace him, perfecting my birth. His presence dispels every puzzle and shame. Though everyone feels him, they don't know his name. His birth and his actions eliminate sin and bless everybody, both women and men. Descriptions of Krishna are joyfully said. All others are wasted, like gems on the dead. He lives in Vrindavan, tends cows, and just plays as gods speak his teachings and sing out his praise. Today, when I come as his driver and guest, the dawns of my lifetime will all have been blessed. When I see Lord Krishna and Balaram too, I'll bow to them both and their whole retinue. Though Kamsa has sent me, the all-knowing Lord will see that I love him with and wish no discord. Then Krishna will place his soft hand on my head. His touch will remove every worry and dread. That hand made the scent of the gopis its own. When Bali adored it, he gained Indra's throne. Infallible Krishna will understand me. Though I must serve Kamsa, I'm his devotee. I'll bow before him, palms together in prayer. His smile will relieve me of any despair. When he sees that I am a kinsman and friend, he'll hug me, and all of my anguish will end. He'll see how his presence has made me inspired, and then, like a wish tree, he'll fill my desires. And as I am standing, my head and hands bowed, Lord Balaram, too, will emerge from the crowd. He'll greet me with honor, and when we're alone, he'll ask about schemes Kamsa dreams from his throne. Meeting the Vrajvasis. Akrura, wrapped in Krishna, barely noticing the road, at sunset reached Gokula, his beloved lord's abode. "Why, those are Krishna's footprints," said Akrura as he parked, distinguished by a lotus bloom and other well-known marks. The feet that all the gods adore indeed had blessed that ground. Akrura, teary-eyed, his hairs on end, at once jumped down and rolled amid the dust that had been touched by Krishna's feet. He lost all fear of Kamsa's wrath and felt his life complete. Proceeding on as quickly as his chariot allowed, Akrura saw Lord Krishna, who had finished tending cows. Lord Krishna's skin was bluish-black and dressed with yellow silk. Lord Balaram was with him, dressed in blue with skin like milk. The brothers strolled like elephants, displaying mighty arms, their lovely faces graced with smiles of endless warmth and charm. They marked the grazing pastures with impressions from their feet of goads for steering elephants, festoons, and lightning streaks. These two primeval deities, descending among men, were freshly bathed and garlanded and decked with precious gems. They seemed to be two mountains, one of silver laced with white, the other made from emeralds, effulgent, rich, and bright. Akrura, overwhelmed with love, fell down as if a rod. His speech impaired and hair on end, in ecstasy he sobbed. When Krishna recognized Akrura, feeling very pleased, he raised him and embraced him as a faithful devotee. Lord Balaram then grasped Krura's folded, prayerful hands and brought him to his residence to learn of Kamsa's plans. He made Akrura comfortable, asked about his trip, massaged his feet, and brought hot honeyed milk for him to sip. Both Balaram and Krishna served Akrura tasty foods and gave to him a first-rate cow in reverent attitude. They brought him after-dinner herbs, fresh garlands, and the rest, in perfect Vedic custom for receiving honored guests. Akrura was quite pleased by his supremely gracious hosts, and listened to the inquiries the gentle Nanda posed. "My dear Akrura, how can you survive with Kamsa there? You seem just like a lamb who's trapped within a butcher's care." That cruel, selfish Kamsa snatched his sister's infant sons and, right before their mother's eyes, destroyed them one by one. Why should we even ask about your health or your well-being when you live in the realm of such a ruthless, heartless king? When he heard Nanda speak in this most candid, trusting way, Akura's deep exhaustion from his journey went away. King Nanda and his sons first fed their uninvited guest, then gently asked Akura to lay down and take some rest. When they stepped out to take their meals, Akura sat in bed, amazed at how the Lord complied with every prayer he'd said. What wish could ever go beyond the Lord's capacity, especially when cherished by a spotless devotee? A devotee's desire differs from a common whim. Such wishes are for Krishna and for service unto him. Lord Krishna then returned to ask Akura for some news. He said, "Beloved uncle, may good fortune come to you. I hope your trip was pleasant and you didn't strain yourself. Are all my friends in Mathura content and in good health?" "Alas, as long as Kongsa lives, what good news can there be? He's nothing but a cancer on our royal dynasty. My parents, how they've struggled since the day that they were wed. They now are both in prison and their 7 children dead. Because of me, their son, who prophets said would kill the king, my parents have been shackled by incessant suffering. At least I have the pleasure of your company today. Please tell me, dear Akura, what has brought you all this way?" Akura said, "When Narada disclosed the secret fact that you are Vasudeva's son, King Kongsa chose to act. He sent me to convey you to Mathura right away, for he has plans to murder you in several different ways." On hearing this, Lord Krishna and his brother, who stood by, guffawed and giggled heartily till tears filled up their eyes. When Nanda came and heard all that Akura had explained, he called the village constable, who went out and proclaimed, "O cowherd men, now listen to King Nanda's new decree. The time has come to pay our taxes. Gather all your ghee. Tomorrow we shall travel to Mathura, give our tithe, and watch some entertainment that King Kongsa shall provide." The gopis stunned. The cowherd men were pleased and thrilled, for coming from small towns, they loved to see Mathura's sights and hear its bustling sounds. Some gopis, on the other hand, quite breathless from distress, showed pallid, ill complexions amid drooping braids and dress. Some other gopis, realizing that Krishna would depart, withdrew themselves like yogis, holding Krishna in their hearts. Still others thought of Krishna's charming speeches, smiles, and play. Remembering his lovely words, they fainted dead away. Would Krishna leave them, even for the briefest span of time? The gopis could not grasp this most unwelcome paradigm. They came together, spoke of Krishna, shared their thoughts and fears, and sang to one another as they shed incessant tears. "O Providence, you have a merciless heart. You put friends together and tear them apart. You gave us our Krishna, his charms and his smiles. Now you take him back like a petulant child. You've come as a Krura, but you are so cruel. You take back your gift like a dishonest fool. We gambled our futures to join him in dance, and now Krishna won't even give us a glance. The Mathura girls will soon greet the sun's rise with tastes of the nectar that pours from his eyes. What use will he have for some bumpkins like us when their honeyed words turn his pledges to dust? As Krishna rides by, crowds will shout with delight, for all of Mathura will rejoice with the sight. This so-called Akura won't care who survives as he chauffeurs Krishna and ruins our lives. Our elders just watch callous Krishna depart. Oh, fate, all the men follow him in their carts. Let's stop him ourselves. We have nothing to lose. Our chaste reputations are already through. We've danced with our Krishna, who smiled with such love and charmed us with glances, kind words, and warm hugs. We'll die not to see him at dusk with the cows or hear his sweet flute. Look, he's leaving us now. And then the gopis all broke down and cried in great despair. Govinda, Damodar, Mukunda, wailing filled the air. Akrura drove off anyway with both of Nanda's sons. The cowherd men left too, in carts with milk goods by the ton. The gopis walked behind this fleet and caught Lord Krishna's eye. They stopped and stared in hopes he'd turn at least to say goodbye. When Krishna saw the broken-hearted gopis feeling spurned, he sent a messenger who said, "He swears that he'll return." The gopis stood as still as figures painted on a wall. They watched until the chariot could not be seen at all. Convinced their lord would not return, they sadly turned away and started chanting Krishna's pastimes every night and day. To Mathura. Akrura and the brothers rode as swiftly as the wind. Arriving at the Jamuna, which washes off all sins, Akrura parked the chariot within a grove nearby. Both Balaram and Krishna drank and felt quite satisfied. Since pious Brahmins like Akrura take 3 baths a day, the boys stayed in the chariot and lingered as he bathed. Immersed in the clear water, chanting prayers with half-closed eyes, at once Akrura saw the boys. He thought in great surprise, "Now, how did my 2 passengers get here so suddenly? They must have left the chariot to swim nearby with me." Akrura turned and saw the boys, still seated, calm and cool. He turned again and, squinting, looked more deeply in the pool. This time he saw Anantasesha circled by a throng of gods and demons, palms together, praising him in song. That thousand-headed lord of snakes, whose skin was snowy white, resembled a great mountain range with peaks of dazzling height. Upon the giant serpent's lap, Lord Vishnu lay at ease. His dark blue body had 4 arms. His reddish eyes looked pleased. With facial features finely formed and large and lovely limbs, he showed the transcendental forms described in Vedic hymns. His neck was like a conch shell graced with 3 successive lines. His monsoon skin was draped in yellow silk that brightly shined. Between Lord Krishna's massive chest and navel, dark and deep, his chiseled stomach, sharply ridged, looked like a banyan leaf. His toenails glowed like petals from effulgent lotus blooms. His 2 right hands held conch and lotus, ready to give boons. His 2 left hands held disc and mace, so demons too were blessed. The Srivatsa mark and Kostuba gem adorned his chest. Around Lord Vishnu, faithful servants prayed with all their hearts. The earth, tulasi plants, and other pious souls took part. His knowledge, wealth, renunciation, beauty, strength, and fame, personified as goddesses, sang out his holy name. To see Lord Vishnu so directly brought Akrura bliss that overwhelmed his heart with lucid, loving consciousness and made his eyes turn tearful as it raised his body's hairs. Akrura joined his palms, bowed low, and spoke these thoughtful prayers. "My Lord, when you appear within this universal void, your navel sprouts a lotus where Brahma has been deployed. Assembling all the energies that you, my Lord, supply, he engineers the universe, as you have specified. This universe of matter, though, where you cannot be found, keeps every soul, even Brahma, perpetually bound. Philosophers, ascetics, priests, and others all may try, but devotees alone know you, for they are purified. When others worship demigods, like Shiva and the rest, they mean to worship you, but somehow falter and digress. And yet, as every river moves from mountain range to sea, such people, by your kindness, come to you eventually. The modes of nature, goodness, passion, darkness, ebb and flow throughout creation, seizing every creature high and low. Thus every deva, man and beast, bewitched and stupefied, enjoys and grieves, as you perceive, with your unbiased eyes. Your endless strength and vital air are found within the wind. The 4 directions are your hearing, mighty gods, your limbs. The fire is your face, the earth your feet, the sun your eye. The ocean is your abdomen, your navel is the sky. The trees are hairs upon your body, clouds your head of hair. Your nails and bones are mountain peaks that tower in the air. Your head itself is heaven, day and night your blinking eyes, and semen from your genitals, the rainfall from the skies. As fish live in the sea, or tiny bugs reside in fruit, the worlds of gods and men alike originate in you. To end the pain of pious souls who love to chant your praise, you come again so willingly in countless different ways. I pray to you as Matsya, Lord of Devastation's Seas. I pray to you as Hayagriva, Killer of the Beasts. I pray to you as Kurma, holding mountains on your shell, and also as Varaha, who supported earth itself. You come as Narasimha to relieve your servant's fear. As Vamana, you step across the universal sphere. As Lord Parasaram, you slay the fallen royal class. As Rama, you slay Ravana, whose strength was unsurpassed. I bow to you as Buddha, who bewilders foolish men. I bow to you as Kalki, bringing Kali Yuga's end. Lord Vasudeva, of the Yadus, you are surely best. Lord Sankarshan, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, my respects. Dear Lord, in this world every soul becomes illusion's serf and walks the path of pleasure that concludes in death and birth. My Lord, I too believe in much that is not as it seems. My precious family, wealth, and fame are simply fleeting dreams. Mistaking body for the soul and misery for joy, I've traded endless love of God for things that time destroys. I'm just a fool who leaves behind a lush, refreshing lake to chase a desert-born mirage and die from his mistake. So weak is my intelligence, it cannot curb my mind. The slave of every evil urge my shameless senses find. Although I can't approach you till my foolishness has ceased, I pray to think of you and serve your spotless devotees. All energy and consciousness, my Lord, arise from you. Why, even nature cannot change your body's innate truth. O Lord of mind and senses, whom all beings live within, protect me, please. I bow to you again and yet again.
Hare Krishna. I'd like to once again thank Kalakanta Prabhu for making this book. It's been a really sweet way to understand these pastimes, especially for my first time hearing them. And definitely so clear, and you know, you can really get the whole gist of the whole story. But one of the first things that emerged to me while reading these pastimes is kind of how easily all these demons are defeated by Krishna, and they're really, you know, no match for him. And in the Krishna book, when a demon such as Arishta is defeated, Prabhupada mentions that there's such joy when one of these demons are killed that it's reflected almost as if a person achieves a wonderful feat, and by that naturally happening, everyone surrounding him is automatically put into complete joy. And that's so reflected in all these stories. Oh, and nonetheless, Kamsa fails again and again to see this, how Krishna is defeating every one of the demons he sends after him. And we read in other pastimes how his devotees are constantly forgetting that he's a supreme enjoyer, all attractive and most powerful out of anybody, any personality. And Kamsa displays such a controlling, manipulative, charming, yet foolish personality at the same time, because he fails to realize this, and nonetheless he arranges this battle and wants wants all these individuals to fight Krishna, and he just can't see ahead that, you know, none of it's going to work out for him. So, similarly, even his devotee, Akura, he's one of the few that, upon seeing Krishna, he's immediately aware that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A lot of his devotees see Krishna as being this wonderful child who's so capable of these amazing feats, yet they don't make the correlation that he's Vishnu himself. Likewise, the sage Narada, he does a similar thing. He's so pure that he's also able to see the future and, you know, foresee that the Bhagavad Gita is going to be fulfilled and that he's going to kill all these demons, the wrestlers, and his elephant, Kamsa's elephant, that is. I wanted to make another point also, that when these, it came up in class the other day, that these demons, when they fight Krishna, they're automatically liberated, and that in to some degree they are serving Krishna because he's allowing Krishna to fight, which is also one of his pastimes that he enjoys, to wrestle and fight with evil personalities. So not only the devotees are serving Krishna, but somewhat indirectly, the demons are serving Krishna as well. I wanted to read something from the Krishna book. Akura considered himself most fortunate that he was going to see Krishna, whom great mystic yogis desired to see. He was confident that on that day, all the sinful reactions of his past life would be finished and his fortunate human form of life would be successful. Akura also considered that he was very much favored by Kamsa, who was sending him to bring back Krishna and Balaram and thus enabling him to see the Lord. Akura continued to consider that formerly great sages and saintly persons were liberated from the material world simply by seeing the shining nails of the lotus feet of Krishna. So this kind of brought up Kamsa's foolishness to my awareness again. And when I was reading this, I was just thinking, is Kamsa aware of this? Does he even care about his servant Akura, that he's going to be liberated when he sees Krishna? Or, you know, he's so demoniac that he just not even care. But nevertheless, you could say in a way that Kamsa's also serving Krishna, not only by sending these demons to try to kill Krishna, but he's sending his devotee towards Krishna. He's kind of like directing him there so that he can be liberated. So I don't know if it's Krishna's way of involving Kamsa in Akura's liberation, but that seemed as something really interesting to me. Another thing about Kamsa, part of which I was kind of confused, maybe somebody in class can clarify this with me as well, but I'm under the impression that Akura is a member of the Yadu dynasty, and I read in the Krishna book, let me just find it. Okay, Kamsa's, you know, once again using his charming personality on Akura, and he says, "My dear Akura, actually I have no better friend than you in the Bhoja and Yadu dynasties. You are the most munificent person, so as a friend I am begging charity from you. Actually, I have taken shelter of you exactly as King Indra takes shelter of Lord Vishnu." But a little further down the page, he says, After killing these two boys, Krishna and Balaram, I shall kill Vasudev and Nanda, who are supporters of the Rishni and Bhoja dynasties. So I saw kind of like another confusing thing in Kamsa's plan. He's praising his servant, and you know, like he says, he's taking shelter of him as Indra takes shelter of Krishna, and saying he's a great friend of the Bhoja dynasty. Yet later on, not much later, he says that he's going to kill all the supporters of the Bhoja dynasties. So it's like, is he just going to leave Akura by himself as like the remaining one of this dynasty? I don't think he'd be like too favorable of that. But no matter what, like I still found it pretty profound that Akura is just devoted towards Kamsa's wish and says, you know, I'm gonna serve him. When I hear that, it occurs to me that Kamsa, like, he's really foolish. Like he's trying to like plan all this out, and he thinks it's gonna work out, like, you know, directly according to his plan. We're kind of fortunate because we get like this perspective of like the audience. We get to see the other things occurring, but it's mentioned in here as well that Kamsa is a diplomat. And you could kind of see the aspect of him that he almost acts like a politician somewhat, like he's trying to scheme his ways and such. And another thing occurred to me when he's arranging this battle, that he's going to do this in a bit as a big sacrifice to Lord Shiva. And I read in the Krishna book as well that this sort of sacrifice is still practiced in India today. Or at least it was when Prabhupada was around. I don't know about today. But just real quick, I'm gonna mention the name. It's called Chaturdasi. Has somebody been familiar with this? I think it's a 14th month. Okay. It's a Kamsa also advised his friends to arrange the worship Lord Shiva by offering animal sacrifices and performing the sacrifice called Dhanur Yagya, and the sacrifice performed on the 14th day of the moon known as Chaturdashi. Falls 3 days after Ekadasi and is set aside for the worship of Lord Shiva. Yet again, this is another example of, I'm sure we'll see later on in this canto that this sort of traditional practice of Vedic ceremonies doesn't really matter if you're surrendering to Krishna, because you know, you can keep fulfilling the desires of the demigods like you would a small river, but until you approach the ocean of Krishna, all the other necessary actions are kind of insignificant. Oh, I wanted to ask another question that came up in Kalakanta's book and in here in the Krishna book as well. The significance of the passing of a deer when Akura is approaching Vrindavan, and is that like a sign of good fortune? A dead body may be decorated very nicely, but without consciousness, such decorations are useless. Likewise, human society without Krishna consciousness is useless and lifeless. I've heard kind of like an ideology prior to coming to Krishna consciousness, and it, you know, various philosophers refer to this idea and kind of outlook of God in society. And it's I could imagine that it's probably worsening nowadays, that this conception that God is dead. And I can imagine this is a pretty frightening ideology. But it was really clarified to me once I started first listening to Prabhupada's lectures. And he talks a good deal about this one topic in a morning walk, I believe. And pretty much he just exclaims outright that God is in dead intelligences. And I heard that one line. I was like, that, I didn't even, you know, take into account the other things he said. That one line said enough. It was really clear that, you know, we're truly becoming dumber. And in this lecture, Prabhupada talks that we think that God's dead because he's not there when we need him necessarily. Or, you know, we're not praying, oh, I really need you right now, Krishna. Can you help me out? That we actually have to change our consciousness if we want to become God realized. And some of his disciples in the lecture bring up the fact that we think we create all these things. Science claims that we're creating this and that, and we're making these great advancements, and we're creating life and doing so much. But Prabhupada almost instantly knocks it down and says, we've ultimately created nothing. We're nothing but laborers, or you could say servants to ourselves, merely using what surrounds us. So he says, you know, we're nothing but laborers. It'd be likewise, we go to like a king's castle and we use his wood to construct, say, you know, a small shed for us to live in. We're not creating the shed. We're not creating the wood he's given us. It's already supplied to us. So we're not creating anything. We're just laboring over, you know, the marble that comes from the earth to make a temple. You know, the list goes on endless. And, you know, not only this isn't limited to the resources he gives, but he also gives us life to begin with, intelligence to be able to use the resources in devotion towards him, or not in devotion towards him. But there's another comment that another one of his disciples brought up, that that humanity or humans live in the cities, or they create the cities, and God resides or creates the country, say the countryside, like the natural farmland and forest. But likewise, he knocks us down ultimately because God is residing over everything, not only in the individual entities, but, you know, those cities didn't come from humans. The resources that built those cities and the positions where people are working in, they're ultimately created by God. And likewise, the country was created by God as well. And to wrap up real quick, in the end he says that if we have this approach that we create cities and we're the dominions of everything we see, and we're also able to destroy things we see in our surroundings, that we have this false conception that we're going to destroy the earth, that we're going to build a bomb and we're going to destroy the earth. But we're mistaken that if we try to cause this devastation, we're not going to destroy anyone but ourselves. It's only to our own demise or benefit as far as what actions we perform. But ultimately, it's like the demons are serving Krishna. Whatever we do, we're going to be fulfilled, because whether we destroy ourselves or try to help each other out and get on the path of spreading Krishna consciousness throughout the world, if we destroy ourselves, by God's mercy, he's gonna draw us in, and he's gonna make us suffer. You know, that's why there's suffering in this world, because we're gonna suffer because he wants us to, because we're trying to enjoy separately from him. And if we try to destroy and not appreciate what he's given us, and he's going to pull us in closer like he does with the demons trying to kill him. So that's it. Thank you.